going to give a talk this evening on the topic of knowing, ways of knowing. They call in the Indian philosophy, they call pramana. Pramana just means like a way of knowing something, a measure of something. And in particular, how this notion of pramana, or measuring, is related to questions of spiritual authority. And as we've seen in the last few weeks with the ruckus around bhikkhuni ordination, that there's been perhaps the most obvious feature of this is how disproportionate it is. Just by doing a very simple act of doing an ordination, even bhikkhuni ordination, though it is a bit unusual these days, has still been done in the Theravada tradition many times before. And yet, somehow this time it has traffic zone. So as I was saying, the most outstanding and quite extraordinary feature of this is the disproportionality of it. There's been this huge global outcry, firestorm, started by a very simple act of performing ordination for women. And for those who are not so familiar with the context and so on, it seems puzzling, inexplicable. But for those of us who've been working within this sphere for many years now, it's really not all that surprising. Although I have to say, I mean, none myself nor Ajahn Brahmo or anyone else, as far as I know, really predicted that this would happen, but certainly it's not surprising that there's some kind of quite irrational response. And so what that tells us is that what's going on is underneath is quite different from what's happening on the surface. We have to learn to read these signs. Don't get distracted with the posturing around legalities and obedience and all these kind of stuff. One of the critical issues is the question of authority, spiritual authority. Many of us, when we come to Buddhism, one of the first things that we learn, and one of the staples of modernist Buddhism, is to say that, to quote from the Kalama Sutta, and say that, you know, we should ultimately rely on ourselves, and that the just because something's passed down by tradition, or because it's included in scriptures, or because a respected monk says that that's the case, that doesn't mean that it is the case. But we ourselves must know and investigate and find out what is right and what is wrong. So of course this is a very powerful teaching, a very empowering teaching. It's one which is very suited to our modern age. It resonates with the way that we're brought up and educated in a democratic society. And it's easy to overlook the fact that it's a teaching which pretty much languished, neglected and unused for probably over 2,000 years until it was spotted and put in the spotlight by some of the modern Sri Lankan monks, probably Walpola Rahula, that kind of generation. And effectively within the mainstream of the Buddhist tradition, and this is probably true of all the traditions, that in fact authority has been highly centralized. There's been strong emphasis on continuity with tradition, a deprecation of individuality, a distrust of individual or idiosyncratic interpretations and takes on the Dhamma. This is not to say by any means that Buddhism has always been monolithic. Far from it. There's always been reform movements, breakaway sects, change and revolutions, both good and bad, going on all the time in all traditions. I would simply say that in terms of the mainstream Buddhist culture, that there's much more of an emphasis on faith, on respecting one's elders, on following traditional ways without making a fuss of it. And I think anyone who's spent time in traditional Buddhist cultures would agree that that's the main emphasis, which really comes across very strongly. And of course there's something beautiful about that. It's not, there's a quiet and simple devotion which we can see in those cultures, which I could see, for example, in the village cultures in northeast Thailand and northern Thailand, where there's just a simple faith that shines through in the people's relation to Buddhism, relation to the Sangha, relation to the Dhamma. And so in a sense that's very beautiful, it's a very lovely quality to see. It's quite manifest, when you're there, it's very delightful. The problem is, of course, that kind of simple faith is completely unequipped to deal with the realities of the modern world. To make Buddhism palatable, to reform it, then these teachings on relying on one's own wisdom have been emphasized and brought to the fore, at least in the kind of the accessible Buddhism which you and I are likely to encounter, the kinds of Buddhism which is published in Dhamma books in English, the kind of Buddhism which is taught by intelligent and educated speakers speaking for a modern urban English-speaking audience. And these are the kinds of things that they're likely to say. Of course, it's important to recognize that the teachings in the Kalama Sutta and so on are only one of a spectrum of teachings on the nature of spiritual authority. And that we can, in a sense, there are a spectrum or a different variety of things offered within the suttas and the Vinaya itself, which can give us various points of view. And of course, that then becomes a matter of interpretation. Are these different teachings, are they actually contradictory? Are they saying the same thing in different words? Are they suitable for different occasions or different persons and so on? And so to understand and interpret that becomes our job, becomes our task as students. And it's important to remember that the overall drive, the overriding concern of a tradition is to create a hermeneutic of unity, that is to develop and to constantly revise and work out an interpretation, a way of thinking, a way of seeing things, which essentially says that what we're doing now is the same thing as our founder taught 2,500 years ago. And that's what you find in all spiritual traditions, and that's an ongoing process. It goes bit by bit by bit, and it's worked out constantly, again and again and again, through the centuries, as new situations are encountered, new problems are brought to light, new challenges need to be met. And this is how, for example, the Roman Church, with its magnificent artworks and its incredible luxuries, manages to convince itself that it's teaching essentially the same thing that was taught by the carpenter from Nazareth. And it's the same process, that gradual unifying, smoothing out, finding or creating consistency and so on, that same process which allows the hierarchies, administrations, bureaucracies in the big capital cities of monks who've never meditated in their life and probably don't even think meditation works, or is very interested in it, and it allows those monks to truly believe for themselves that they are teaching the same dispensation that was taught by the Buddha. So from a student's point of view, you know, we're really interested just to find what's the teachings and how to practice it, that's all. And we can see from our modern times that very many people in the West, obviously the vast majority of people in Western countries or in modern urban settings, I'm a bit hesitant to say Western these days because actually I see much more similarities between what happens, say, in Australian cities and what happens, say, in Singapore, KL or Jakarta or something like that. To me, these things seem to be very similar, very closely related. So say in modern urban settings, most people who are sincere about their Dhamma practice really want to just find out what is the teaching and how can I apply it in my life. And they're not concerned, they're interested in the institutions of Buddhism and these kinds of things. These are pretty relevant as far as the spiritual path goes. If we seek the monastic path, we seek to ordain in the Sangha, then these things become relevant for one reason or another. And one of the main issues is property, land, buildings, who controls the buildings. And this, of course, is a crucial thing. If you've got property, then you can have the Sangha. You know, it's not possible in a country like Australia to just wander around and stay in the forest or something, or maybe you can do it for a while, but you can't actually build a Sangha like that. So if we want to have any kind of serious development of the Sangha in Australia, you need to have land, you need to have buildings and property. And so this becomes a critical issue for the Sangha, for the development of the Sangha. And so of course with property comes wealth, and wealth is power, and power is all these worldly dhammas. And so this is how these worldly dhammas get involved in things. Even though, you know, we just want to give everything up. We come to the Dhamma because we don't want to be involved in these things. We don't want to be involved in the politics. We don't want to be involved in all of that money and all of this kind of rubbish. It's precisely why we're here. And so what often happens is that there's more, as I say, a mutual conspiracy between the young monastics and the senior monastics. So the senior monastics basically want to run things because it's easier for them to just say, let's do this or let's do that. And they think that they know what's right and what's wrong. And of course the junior monastics just want to come along and meditate and study the Dhamma, and they don't want to be concerned with the administration and running a place and so on. So they're quite happy to hand over the power to the ajahns and only gradually and after a long time, as in my case, do you begin to very, very slowly and painfully and stupidly. In my case, and it's taken me years, even though I've been given very good advice about this by many people who were much more insightful than I've been. But it's still, you know, I'm still being in denial, and I'm still remembering things that I've been told years ago and that I dismissed, and that now I look at them and I think, well, actually, that was quite true. And so gradually begin to realize that this way of doing things is quite dangerous, and to look at how things actually were done in the Vinaya, in the Dhamma, and to realize that it's a much more beautiful and much more meaningful way of going about things. So if we come back to this question of the Pramana, the ways of knowing. Now in Indian philosophy generally they make a distinction between two ways of knowing. And the first way is direct experience, prachaksha. It literally is what stands before your eyes. And the other thing, the other kind of knowing is usually anumana, which is inference. So I've spoken of these previously in our sutta classes and so on. So the direct experience, what's actually present in your consciousness at that moment, and also inference. And if we just sitting here now, we can see for ourselves the difference between these two kinds of things. So we just sit here and focus on the question of that aspect of the prajaksha, what's actually you can experience. And for myself, I can experience the hard feeling of the seat that I'm sitting on. I can feel the roughness of the woolen shawl that I have, the cool feeling of the air, slightly cool feeling of the air here in the cave. I can hear slight sounds of people shifting in the seat. I can of course hear the sound of my own voice, which drones on and on. I get so used to it, I can just ignore after a while. And that's a good piece of advice my dad told me once. He said, once you realize that you can just stand next to yourself and listen to your own talk as you're going on, you realize there's something wrong, you've got to stop there. And I can feel the tensions in my body, slight ache I have in my neck and so on. And so these are the different things which are present to my experience, and of course the ideas that arise in my mind, the thoughts and so on which come up, which are directly present to experience. So this is the prachaksha, the immediately given experience presented through the six doors of consciousness. And then the anumana, of course, is also a very complex and very interesting area. So for example, some aspects of anumana or inference would be that, say, if I hear somebody sneezing or something in the people listening, then there's immediately an inference, oh, it's so-and-so that's sneezed or has moved or something like that. And so there's like a connection in the mind between a sound and an idea or a memory, a name. Okay, so of course the sound itself is just sound, it doesn't bring a name with it. The name is something, is an inference which I brought from my own mind. And of course, as we know, that inference, it can sometimes be right and sometimes be wrong. We all know the examples and the cases of where our own perception or our own idea of things actually turns out to be quite incorrect. So, and yet that anumana, even though it can be incorrect, is also completely essential. We can't do without it. Right? You can't simply just come back to raw data of experience and expect to be able to live like that. That's not the point. We need to use inference, but the point is that we need to understand that it is inference and understand what is the process, how does it work, and so that we're not confused about it. So one of these two aspects or two categories are fairly generally accepted throughout the Indian philosophy. And yet, of course, they'd always squabble endlessly about the details. And one of the details, and the most interesting details which they always squabbled about, was the question of the authority of tradition. And in some epistemological systems, the authority of the tradition was a separate kind of way of knowing. So it's usually described as being like a reliable witness or a reliable voice, a reliable testimony. So sometimes that's the third pramana, third way of knowing, and sometimes it's subsumed under inference. And so the relationship between these things can be construed in various ways. But there is always, in the Indic tradition, this attempt to acknowledge that we can actually learn true things from a tradition. And even though it's not necessarily true in the same sense that, say, the quality of the sound that you hear in your ear right now is true. Okay, that has an immediacy of truth, which is unlike anything else. Nevertheless, the truths that are handed down by a tradition are still true in some sense, and they can still be useful, and they can still be beneficial, and they can still lead to nirvana. And we read the suttas teach us of the Four Noble Truths. The teaching in the suttas of the Four Noble Truths is not the same as the direct realization of the Four Noble Truths. And yet it's obviously an essential precursor to that. It's something that's helping us, it's pointing us towards that. And so we need to find some way of balancing these things out, so we don't simply dismiss the tradition and say, we rely only and solely on our own immediately presented experience. If we take that road, then we are much more following the teachings of, say, Krishnamurti, who rejected any notion of experience, and even rejected the notion of memory. and pointed only to the actual experience presented in the present moment. And that's not being the Buddhist way. That's like a part of a Buddhist practice, but it's not the whole thing. So from a Buddhist point of view, we relate to a tradition in some way. And it's not that we discard a tradition, but we have to relate to it in some way that's quite serious or meaningful. And you all know that I have a bit of a reputation, which has probably been enhanced in the last couple of weeks, of being a bit radical or progressive or something like that. But you also know that radicalness and that progressiveness is based on a very, very serious and very, very long-term study and investigation into the actual roots and histories of the Buddhist tradition. And something which I've pursued over the last 16 years, and I've done, as much or more work on that than just about anybody else around the place. And, in that sense, I sort of see myself as following in method, say, the footsteps of someone like, say, Ajahn Buddhadasa. Bhikkhu Bodhi also does a similar thing, Master Yinshun in the Taiwanese tradition, and several others who sort of approach the Dhamma in a similar kind of way. Not necessarily that we're saying the same things, but just approach this at a similar attitude towards it. So in this process as we're going along, we call into question various things which are which maybe have been handed down or maybe passed down to us, and there is a dialogue or a tension between these things. So, for example, and this has been, this has been characteristic of my life ever since I went to the monastery, and since I started out at Wat Nanachar, there's always a tension between what's done in the Thai tradition and what's done according to Dhamma Vinaya. And of course, many times there's no problem, there's a lot of overlap there, and in some cases there is a lot of tension, a lot of difference between those things. And any tradition will always negotiate these polarities. And as long as, this is really the critical point here, as long as those two aspects are talking to each other, then in a sense that will probably be a reasonably healthy approach. As long as there's a capacity for dialogue, for feedback, for interchange, then those two different aspects can always help each other, support each other, maybe complement each other. They can look for common ground. They can look for aspects that are mutually supporting. Okay, so I mean, just to give a simple example of this, say that again, that tension that I found between the Thai tradition and the Dhamma Vinaya taught by the Buddha. Now, the thing I found most useful from the Thai tradition and the forest tradition is their insistence on the practicality of the Dhamma, the application of the Vinaya and the various forms of kawat and so on, in actually running a monastery on a day-to-day basis, living a life, how you wear your robes, how you keep your kuti clean, how you go about the meditation, how you go on alms round. All of these kinds of things are taught very well and practiced very well in the forest tradition, and I think anybody would agree with that. And so there's a great practical example where modelled good behaviour in those things, those aspects of the practice. And so that's why I was drawn to the tradition, that's why I found it very beautiful and very inspiring and very beneficial for many years. But then there are other aspects that I never found within the forest tradition, which I felt were very lacking. And the aspect, for example, of having a coherent philosophical understanding of the Dhamma. I never found anything like that remotely like that within the forest tradition. It's an explanation of the dependent origination, for example. It's a very central teaching the Buddha taught it hundreds of times. Obviously, he thought it was worth learning and studying and applying oneself to, and yet within the Thai forest tradition, I found nothing that would help me to really understand that. And so I had to turn elsewhere, to the suttas, to the writings of Bhikkhu Bodhi, Ajahn Brahm and others, to help me to understand that teaching. And so, you know, I would think that that's a great benefit, which, for example, like a sutta-based approach could bring to the forest tradition, and something which can enrich. The forest tradition doesn't change or alter the insights and the teachings that the forest tradition masters are teaching, but to me it enriches it and improves it. And so I think that in those sense, those things are good. With these things and with these different ways of knowledge, of course, then there's these different epistemological means, these different pramanas are emphasized. And in the meditation schools, of course, you'll always find that they emphasize direct experience over inference, over book learning, over logic, and so on. And this is a very, very seductive teaching. And I want you to all be very conscious of this. You know, one of the things that you'll find, if you find Westerners who go to, or say, not Westerners again, I'm trying to make it a kind of racial thing, but say people from not necessarily a traditional Buddhist background, but from an English-speaking background, and they go to like a modern urban background, and go to a monastery, to a meditation centre, very often, you know, you hear, certainly from the Thai tradition, what they say is, oh, you think too much. Kit mark. Oh, you're thinking so much. You know, just calm down, you don't have to think so much. And it's a very, very seductive teaching, because of course we are all thinking too much. It's very true. And our minds are racing, and we go, God, can I just stop thinking? And we need some kind of break. I mean, that's why people do so much, you know, kind of the recreation and things that people do. They get drunk, take drugs, do extreme sports, all of these kinds of things. They go surfing. So you can sit there and not think. You need some kind of space in our mind. So you go to a teacher, the teacher says, oh, you just think too much, and by keep mark. You're thinking so much. And you think, yes, I am. Please teach me how to not think. And of course, it's a very powerful, it's a very important teaching. You have to learn that. That's one of the critical things about Buddhism. We have to learn to stop thinking. Ah, and then the knowing mind opens up. That's one of the essential core teachings of meditation. Stop thinking, the knowing mind opens up. And of course, immediately that happens, we realize, oh, that knowing, it's so beautiful. It's so serene. Doesn't have all the worries and the concerns. I just know. And as soon as that happens, you are attached. You immediately fall in love with it. You get addicted to it without even knowing. And so then it sets up in the mind of meditators, in the mind of Buddhist followers, this dichotomy, thinking bad, knowing good. Rather than recognizing that actually thinking and knowing are both aspects of the mind. They're neither good nor bad in and of themselves. They're just things that we do. That's how consciousness works. And so we don't judge one is good and one is bad, but we work with them appropriately in the appropriate context. If we want to meditate and know the deep peace that comes just from watching the breath, then we don't think. We train our mind to be able to go beyond thinking. On the other hand, if we need to work something out, we need to understand something, then we need to think about it. We need to use logic. And so this use of logic and reason is something that's almost been completely lost certainly from the Thai forest tradition. It's very obvious if you look at the suttas, how structured they are, how the Buddha would, you know, basically the structure of every sutta is almost the same as the structure of the 6-word news report, isn't it? You start out, you give the headline, say this is what we're going to talk about for the next half an hour, then you talk about it, expand about it, and then you sum up at the end, you give the headlines again, this is what we've talked about. And that's the structure of almost every sutta. And in the Thai forest tradition and so on, you know, they have this kind of wonderful ramble thing where it just sort of starts and just sort of goes on and just follows the flow of the Dhamma, and it goes in and out and to everywhere and back again and round and round. What I'm suggesting here is that this thought, this teaching, to say, don't think, just know. That is very alluring. It speaks to the spiritual narcissism inside each of us. It speaks to that inside us which wants to, just wants to get pleasure and wants to get happiness, wants to be freed from this kind of the suffering of thinking and so on. And so we tend to get attached to it. We identify with that as our Buddhism. And that has very important political ramifications, because obviously if you've got a monastery full of people who don't think, or rather, of course you never have a monastery full of people who don't think, you've got a monastery full of people who think, because everyone thinks, right? But what you have is a monastery full of people who think and feel guilty about thinking. They think it's bad that they're thinking, and they think if they really had wisdom that they wouldn't be thinking. And so they're embarrassed to say, well, I think that, because as soon as they've done that, they've admitted that they've got an opinion, and opinions and views are bad. And if you'd only just be able to let go of that, not have any views, then everything would be fine. So this is how the structure goes. This is how these kinds of situations tend to develop. So it's very important to recognize and to come back to this this question of the pramanas, and hopefully you're seeing now, I'm trying to emphasize that these ways of knowing which are fundamental to the Indic philosophy, and I should mention, as I've shown in various sutta classes previously, that these are found quite explicitly within the suttas as well, even though the developed philosophy of them came much later, but these different ways of knowing are found quite clearly in the suttas. For example, in the Nidana Samyutta, in the Jnana Watthoni suttas, it speaks of the Dhamma Jnana and Anvaya Jnana, the knowledge with respect to Dhamma. In that case, means that the presently arisen Dhamma, and Anvaya Jnana is the inferential knowledge. So it's found quite clearly there. So these things are not just a philosophical speculation or reflection or whatever, but they have very definite and practical political ramifications and practical ramifications in terms of, for example, who makes the decisions in the monastery. And once you've set up that system, the problem is that once you've set up that system and you can see how this thing works now, you come along, students come along, the teacher says, oh, you really think too much. You just got to thinking, oh, it's so terrible. We think a lot, we have lots of views and opinions, and we just get so attached to our views. Can't you see that? If you have a view about something, and somebody else has a different view about it, then you argue about it. The truth is one. The truth is how it is, and so why are you arguing about the views? And so the students, oh, okay, that's such wonderful wisdom, that's such powerful wisdom. So you let go of thinking, let go of views. You feel guilty whenever you think and have views. And so the monastery runs, of course, according to the thinking and the views of the one who's doing the teaching. That's me. Right? And most of the time, if you don't dig too deeply, what's the problem? You're happy? I might say, I'm going to build a kuti over there. Oh, well, I'll build a kuti over there. You know, I might say, well, let's paint the house this colour. Okay, we'll paint the house that colour. I don't have a view about that. Yeah. Oh, we need to resurface the road. We'll put some more topping on the road and make it easier for cars to come in. Okay, I don't have a view about that. We're going to do it. And so it kind of rolls along. And we all think that it's pretty much okay. And then sometimes things happen where you realize that, no, I'm not quite sure whether this is okay anymore. One of the earliest examples of that happened to me was my first rains retreat. Just trying to get the facts in my head now. My first rains retreat, I spent the Vassa at Phujomgom, a very beautiful hermitage right on the easternmost tip of Thailand. And I spent the Vassa there with five bhikkhus, if I can remember them rightly. Dhammavaro, Sambhavaro, Yatiko, Katanyuto, myself. And Katanyuto, I think, was a novice at the time. Visuddhi. And for five bhikkhus and one novice, and all of those, I'm the only one still surviving. anyone still keeping on going in the robes. Perhaps I'm the only one without any options, I don't know. But and at the end of the Vasa we had a katina, because we had the five bhikkhus, so we could have a formal proper katina. And one of the basic, most fundamental basic principles of a katina is that whatever's offered at the katina is for the sangha in the monastery. And there's very clear rules about this in the Vinaya, that the katina offerings are meant for the sangha there. And, you know, even though normally in the sangha we share everything. So, you know, if somebody comes through and they says they want a robe, we give them a robe. You know, we don't want to hold on to anything. But with the katina cloth and the katina offerings, they should be kept just for the sangha that's in the monastery, at least for a period of time. It's very clear that that's meant for them. So at this katina, there was a certain amount of funds were offered and so on. We went back then after to the katina at Wat Manachan, which of course was like the head of Pujam Kong. And the abbot at that time, Ajahn Vyasara, just said, oh yeah, Pudum Khan doesn't need that katina money that they got, we'll just use it maybe for printing books or something. And of course I'd only ordained for one vasa, so I didn't really have much to say, but I noticed that the other monks, more senior monks, such as Sangaro, was quite a bit put out by that. Damawaro, the five vasa monk or something at the time, he's since destroyed, but he was the one who'd been staying at Pudum Khan for the longest, and he sort of piped up and said, well, actually there are a few things that we need. Actually, we need to, typically, you won't even need to guess what he said that they need. Of course, what they need was more tools for the tool shed. Obviously. So there was a bit of discomfort there. But you know, he's the Ajahn, and what he says goes, and so on, and so. This is how you gradually become acclimatized to this way of doing things. You gradually begin to think that it's normal, and it's appropriate, and it's not normal, it's not appropriate, it's not the way that things should be done. So we're in our approach to the Dhamma, needs to be in a more holistic point of view. Now, it needs to give a due weight, a due respect to that aspect of anumana, inference, and not to fetishize the importance of direct experience. So I use the phrase the narcissism of consciousness. It's this idea that direct experience is everything, and that's simply not what the Buddha taught, and it's quite a dangerous teaching. Now, one of the things that you'll notice is the difference between those two is that direct experience always happens in the present. Okay, so as we're meditating, we say we watch the present moment, that's what we're doing. We're developing that aspect, awareness of the present moment, right here, right now. What is the face of experience that's presented to us? Okay? Inference, anumana, extends to the past and the future. This is one of its essential qualities. It's involved in time, just like language is involved in time because of its use of tenses. So if you say anything, especially if you say anything in a language like Pali, you're immediately committing yourself to time because you have to use tenses. It's an interesting sutta where the Buddha talks about this and about how whenever you use any means of speech, that you'll always somehow commit yourself, involve yourself in time. And I kind of wonder whether he would have made that same kind of claim if he was Chinese. Because of course if you're speaking Chinese you can say things without reference to time, but in Indic languages you can't. So the anumana is committing ourselves to time, okay, past and the present, and that has a dhamma, a straightforward dhammic implications. For example, as is taught in the Nidana Sanghita, where you have the direct experience and you can see, well, everything in the present moment, for example, is impermanent. I can see this is impermanent, this is changing. And you can infer from that to the past and the future. Everything in the past must also have been conditioned and impermanent. Anything that happens in the future must also be conditioned and impermanent. And so this is how we let go of the past and the future, by understanding in this way. But that aspect of time and involvement in time also has the practical dimension as well. And this is why it's very important for you to understand that, especially for those of you who are young monastics and for those of you who are interested to take up a monastic life, to please remember this, that it has time is involved. What it is like for you here now is only one thing. That's only one aspect of it. Okay, you're sitting here, you're in a cave with this group of people, we're listening to this Dhamma talk, these events have been going on, it's like this in this monastery with these people now. But this is only one part of what you're doing. And remember that the choices that you make right now will determine what happens to you in your life for a long time in the future. Your choices are going to that you make now are going to shape your life, for better or for worse, for a long time in the future. And that we can only understand through anumana, through inference. We can't understand that through direct experience. And you can sit in your kuti and know the present moment until kingdom comes. You can sit there until Maitreya Buddha arises and watch the present moment arising and ceasing. And it's not going to help you one little bit to know and to understand these things that I've been talking about. They're quite different aspects of the mind. When I say it's not going to help you one little bit, that's probably an exaggeration. When we do watch, that is an exaggeration. When we do watch the mind, we do watch the present moment, that gives us a clarity, it gives us a space in our mind, and that means that our ability to reason and use inference is enhanced. We can be clearer about how we think and so on. So the clarity of mind we get from watching the present moment is useful for us in developing the inference. There's no doubt about that. These two things are supporting each other. But yet, the point I'm trying to make is that just doing the present moment alone is not that those kinds of truths or kinds of understandings will never come to us. We're closing ourselves off from that world unless we can learn to engage with and trust our own inference, our own ability to reason and logic, use logic and so on. And so these are some of the things that we need to consider very carefully. So for example, a question like, say how is a monastery run? Say, who makes the decisions? What is the process by which these things are happening? Now this is something which is evolving and changing in this monastery, and so it should be. But it's something which you should not feel powerless in, and you should not feel subject to. It's something that we need to create together, and it's something which I am learning as I go. And this is something which I mentioned before, that in the Thai forest tradition we are often modelled, given very good models for certain kinds of things. Now this is something which we are not given very good models for. We are not modelled in the behaviour of learning how to live with a community, to listen to and to respect the needs of the people in the community, and to work to move together in things. That we're not modelled that behaviour at all. And so I have to ask for forgiveness and understanding from you, so you can recognise that I haven't had that modelling and that training, and so I'm really having to learn this as I go along. And so I like to, my ideal, my hope is that I can provide some spiritual leadership and direction. I can give guidance in say questions of the Vinaya, how things should be gone about in Vinaya and so on. But you also need to step forward, and you also need to own your responsibility for what's happening. And if we're having a meeting or community meeting or something, and you just decide, I'm just going to sit here quietly and not have any thoughts and not have any views and not have any opinions, then that doesn't help. It doesn't help me, it doesn't help the people around us. So sometimes it might be difficult to step forward and to say things. I know that. And sometimes you maybe feel that your contribution is not valued or that your opinion is worthless. And if that's the case, then you just have to accept my apologies or the apologies from others. But don't stop. Don't give up just because you feel like maybe you haven't been listened to, or maybe you know, your opinion wasn't valued in that time. Keep trying. The more that you keep trying, then the more we can learn from each other, and the more we can create a much healthier way of being together as Sangha. So it's true that if we have that kind of process, that it's more, you know, it's not as peaceful, you know, in right now, in the present moment. Of course it's more peaceful to just sit there and be told what to do. It's a very peaceful way to live, just to have someone tell you what to do and just be a slave. But it's not a mature way to live. It's not a dhammic way to live. It's a lazy and incompetent way to live. So this is why, as if we're mature adults, as members of a spiritual community together, we need to share that responsibility. And that's partly my job, and it's a job which I do, you know, falteringly and hesitatingly and in fits and starts and with all kinds of mistakes along the way. And then I look back and wish I'd done things differently. But partly that's my job, is to extend this invitation and encourage a contribution from the members of the community. But it's also, you need to reciprocate. And it's not good enough to just sit there and be quiet and not say anything, and at the end of the day to leave and say, oh, the monastery isn't right because of this and that. Okay? That's what a lot of people do in monasteries, what I've seen ever since I've been a young monk. People, they sit, they don't say anything, they don't contribute, and then they go away and they whinge and they complain because it wasn't right according to their thoughts. So that's not proper practice. We need to create this together. We need to create a community and a way of understanding and working that can be informed by the Dhamma and Vinaya, and where we can learn to value and appreciate each other's contributions. So this is my little talk for you this evening on authority, ways of knowing, and so on and so forth.